Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And this is episode 4 of Sublimely Gothic. Today we're talking about the first contemporary gothic novel of our podcast, The 13th Tale. Written in 2006 as the debut novel of Diane Setterfield, it has all our classic gothic tropes with family secrets, burning mansions, and potential ghosts. I don't usually have a spoiler warning since most of the books we cover are centuries old, but as a newer contribution to the gothic genre, I advise that if you have not read this book and do not wish to be spoiled, you should stop listening right now. Okay then, 13th Tale. What did you think of it? You just read it.
I just read it, yeah. I know I always like come to these and I'm like, oh, I'm just about to read this. But this had been on my to-read list just because, as we said, we're both gothic lit fans. And I really enjoyed it. I think last time we talked about the twist or the mystery, no, did not see that coming. I feel like I've been able to predict those things in other books. And I was just like, did I read that right? And then now I like want to go over and reread it and see all the things that would point to it. The third girl. No idea.
Yes, but I was completely blindsided when I first read that.
Oh,
didn't
my
see it coming at all.
No, but like how, but I just was floored. I'm like, how smart, you know, have a third girl that looks like the other girl's long red hair. I don't know. I was very impressed with that. What about you? Read it a while ago, right?
Yeah, I read it a while ago, like 9 months, a year ago in my book club, and it was actually the first contemporary book that was chosen for the group. Up till then, we had stayed in, like, again, the 18th, 19th century, and so I was a little skeptical of bringing a contemporary one, but it wasn't my turn to pick, but it ended up being really good. And again, yeah, it follows the same Jane Eyre type of, you know, building up all the paranormal stuff, but the mystery is actually very logical and very mundane, but it's a really good twist.
Speaking of Jane Eyre, that's like the ghost of this podcast because it keeps popping up. And in that book, in The 13th Tale, I was like, it was referenced throughout. It was, I don't know, there were a lot of little nods to
another reason why I picked Jane Eyre as our first episode.
You're so smart. I mean, I that's perfect. It only makes sense. It's just been a consistent through this. And how surprising because to me, I was kind of like, I kind of knew this kind of danced with gothic, but I really liked this. I do like a lot of contemporary fiction. And I thought this was a really unique way of telling the story too, you know, rather than just laying out, do you say Vita? Is that how you say her name?
Vita Winters, yeah.
Yeah, just kind of her telling her story. It was kind of nice to have Margaret there to kind of bounce off and just kind of be the reader within the book. I don't know, I thought it was a really unique narrative technique. So
yeah, no, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. But before we get too far into our discussion, we of course have to do our 60 second recap. And you just read it, you're the freshest, so you get to go first.
Oh god, you know what, I was gonna plan this out better today, and then I was like, I'll just do it on the fly. It's probably better that way.
I'll count you in at 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so there is a woman who lives basically at a bookstore. I mean, she lives at the bookstore. She grew up reading. She's a book fan. She gets this mysterious letter from this author who she's never read any of her books, but then she's like, I gotta read these books. So she reads these books and then goes to our lovely Vita Winters' house, and Vita's telling her the story of her life, or is it? We don't know. And Margaret's slowly pulling out all these little clues about her life. A couple times Margaret's like, is she really telling me the truth? And there is, like we said, a third sister, a child that almost gets roasted, which was very disturbing. A secret child. It all wraps up and everybody lives sort of happily ever after. That's it.
And time's up.
Good, perfect. All right.
Alrighty then, let me try to take a crack at it.
All
Okay.
right, go.
Okay, so Margaret lives in a bookshop with her father. They make their living by facilitating really expensive sales of really antique books. She gets commissioned by Vida Winters, a super well-known author, to write her biography. But Vida is interesting is because she's never really told the truth about her past before. And so it's this whole mystique of her past, particularly with her book, The 13th Tale. And then, so she starts telling tale, tells the story of Angelfield, the mansion with the twins, Adeline and Emmeline, and they are both disturbed in their own ways, Emmeline being docile, Adeline being very violent. Lots of stuff happens, creepiness, governess doesn't know what's going on, fire, child, third sister, and Emmeline dies at the end, and Vida Winter dies, and yeah, that's it.
Beautiful. Oh, there's my timer too. I think we did a good job of wrapping that up. Picked up on a little bit of different elements, so that's good.
Yes. So again, your memory is fresher than mine. What any specific things would you like to discuss first?
I think this because it's a contemporary book or contemporary novel. I didn't admittedly do a lot of research on like any kind of scholarly assessment of this book, but because it's fresher, it was kind of easy for me to get lost in the story of it. I mean, obviously, since we were reading Gothic literature, to notice the tropes that were there. But as far as aspects of it, I just think the ghost was really well done. I was really intrigued by that, intrigued by the ghost, and the turns that it took at the end really surprised me. Adeline, I wrote little notes about her in Emmeline. I'm probably saying their names wrong. I wrote the psycho sister and the chill sister, but it was pretty clear that one of them had was very influenced by their father, which was also, man, talk about a wild relationship there, with Isabella and or Isabel and Charlie. That
Yes, it's not directly, they probably did have an incestuous relationship at some point, but it's never directly stated whether or not the twins are products of incest or not.
Okay. Well, when I started reading that, I got like this when it started going that direction, when Charlie and Isabel are, he like hits her with a barbed wire or something like that, and she's like into it. I was like, "Whoa. Where are we going?" I thought that was pretty wild. Yeah, so I haven't really focused on any specific aspects. I just feel like it did the Gothic genre really well in modernizing it. That was my initial takeaway.
And I'm glad you enjoyed the twist at the end because I remember in Jane Eyre, you were so dying for the ghost to actually be ghost. And it seems
Right.
in this one, there were no real ghosts, but they modernized the rationalizing of the plot in a way that made it, super, innovative.
Yeah.
So what do we think? I have my own notes here that I just compiled. What do we think of Vida's Winter's moral compass or lack thereof?
I mean, the author really messed with that, because for a while you think, or the reader, me in this case, thinks she's this like I secret psychotic sister who's just like wants to watch the world burn. And it was weird to kind of think about her through that lens, because here she is, this like dying woman telling someone her story. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, what, when did she take the turn from not being so, kind of evil and malicious to like writing her stories? Like, what was the catalyst for that? And then it's like, oh, well, okay. It took a totally different turn. But what are your thoughts on that? Like her moral compass, I don't know. For a while I thought it was kind of evil, and then I was kind of like, she just kind of was an abandoned child who was just trying to figure it out, you know? But I don't know.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, in the beginning, Diane Setterfield really builds up the this is not a very nice woman because she's very rude to Margaret and she's like, oh, I abhor polite people, like, and that sort of thing. So that was very jarring, like when we first meet her. And then in the whole retelling of the story, when we think she's Adeline, it's like, oh, that makes sense. She was a nasty little violent brat. You know, when she was a kid, and since she's gotten older, she's still nasty, but she's not nearly as, you know, violent or psychotic because she realized that that doesn't get her very far in normal society. But then when you realize that she wasn't Adeline, that she was the third sister slash cousin, again, unclear of their exact relation, it's never, I think it's purposely left ambiguous. But yeah, but upon realizing that she is the third sister and that she was not a part of of Adeline's like madness and nastiness, and actually saved Emmeline's baby from, you know, from Adeline's attempted murder. It's like, oh, okay. It's like, you know, obviously it draws her in a much more sympathetic light, and her nastiness as an adult is not stemming from childhood psychopathy as Adeline is, the real Adeline is portrayed, but more of, you know, she had to lie in her life just to survive because basically she existed off the grid well until her teenage years, until finally she had to assume Adeline's identity.
Well, and when they have the fire, she kind of they never give her a name, do they? The
No,
Vita.
she never has her own name, and we only ever know her as her nom de plume, Vita Winters.
She basically saves the wrong sister, not, you know, in her mind, I'm guessing, kind of like the tragedy from the fire, because the two girls are like fighting with each other, and then she pulls one out of the fire and then is kind of named, oh, you're this person, right? And she's like, sure, whatever. That whole scene was pretty dark. I mean, you're putting a baby on a fire. I was like, what is going on here? This is pretty dark. Thankfully the baby was rescued, but I don't know why that really got to me. I guess it's if it didn't get to me and I was like totally like, oh, this is fine. Maybe I would need to seek some help. But
I think, you know, I think it's purposely left ambiguous on whether the twins are products of incest because through Hester and the doctor, they're trying to figure out what is wrong with the twins because clearly they're both disturbed in their own ways and that may or may not be related to their identity as twins. And so I think it's left to the reader to question, like, are there cognitive psychological issues deriving from the fact that they are products of incest and like genetic complications and that sort of thing?
Well, that's something that I think I left out of my summary because it wasn't too, it didn't have, I don't, it didn't take place for a long duration in the novel. I mean, this book is pretty hefty. How many pages is this? Like 406 pages. Was the separating the twins like that obviously had, you know, I don't remember it being a long time, but it had a significant effect on the two twins, which Hester was like all in on doing that with Dr. Maudsley. She's like, yeah, these girls are, you know, need to get it together. So let's see what happens when we separate them. And I was kind of like, this is kind of not too great. But I don't think it had a positive effect on either girl. If anything, it made Adeline worse.
Yeah, so I remember first reading that part with Hester and like Hester is like, where is Adeline or whatever, and then seeing the third child but not thinking it's Adeline and rushing to who is it, that Dr. Maudsley's house, that's where Adeline's being kept, and she's there and she's like, I'm going insane.
Absolutely. I guess you would feel like you would. I don't, that, yeah, I forgot about that part. That was wild.
Yeah, because I was so trying to think, okay, I'm like, are we really doing a ghost? Like, okay, how are we going to tie all of this together? And I still couldn't figure it out.
No, me neither. I thought, when they talked about the body in the, the building burns down.
Yeah, the body in the library.
Yeah, I thought it was Hester. I was like, all
Yeah, well,
right.
you're definitely supposed to think it's Hester because Hester le basically skips town and you don't know what happened to her.
She ends up going to America and becoming a doctor. Is that right? Or do I make
Yeah, she ends up go like they're for a while they play with the notion of maybe she got murdered and that body is in the library is Hester, which would kind of make sense because if she saw the third child that no one's supposed to know about, then maybe someone killed her. So that would have played into the secret plot twist, but they decided that
Right.
no, she just went ran off to America, and after the doctor's wife died, he joined her and they got married.
The, how romantic. It's something worked out for the good for old Hester. Which that brings me to their kind of relationship, that kind of these characters around the periphery, which, Margaret and Vita and the twin girls are very much, kind of the focus of the story, but the characters around them, I feel like this is the first time. Well, the last book we talked about was The Phantom, and I actually watched the movie after we
Oh, did you?
talked.
What'd you think?
I was so mad the whole time. I was mad the person
As many
wasn't
other
there.
people were. Why were you mad
Yes.
by it?
Oh my gosh, it was like, well, knowing they omitted such a great character, and then they were just like slashing and dashing stuff, and I was just like, I watched it with my mom, and I'm going, she's like trying to guess the ending. I'm like, I don't know what is going on right now. I'm like, let's just watch and find out together because this is going all over the place. But anyway, sorry. So mainly, I was bummed that the Persian wasn't there, and I could see, I don't know, it just bummed me out. But so characters on the periphery of this story, John the Dig, to me, he was the good guy in this story. Like, I felt so bad when his topiary got destroyed by these two little hellions. He was obviously heartbroken by that, but.
Yeah, and actually, I think I didn't truly guess that there was a third child, but John the Dig, in his interactions with the real Adeline, and then though we don't know it, his interactions with Vida, though we don't know what her name ever was, that is the biggest, I think, clue that I could have possibly gotten to, like, why is this guy, again, where Adeline totally trashed his garden, why has suddenly he changed his tune towards quote unquote Adeline, when in reality
Yeah.
he knows it's actually a different girl, which is why though that dynamics are so different.
Okay. I forgot about that part. Yeah, because he does. He's so gutted when that happens. And then he's like, eh, let me show you how to do this or whatever. And but I liked that character. I thought he's a hard worker, seemed like a decent person, and he's got
And
some
Adeline
weird
threw
things.
off the ladder and killed him.
I was mad at her. I was like, what are you doing? This is the good guy. What do you think her motivation was in that? Just jealousy, basically.
I don't like it's hard to I think I highlighted a spot in the book, like trying to describe where Hester is describing Adeline's behavior, because I really like this. It is as if there is a mist in Adeline, a mist that separates her not only from humanity but from herself. And sometimes the mist thins, and sometimes the mist clears, and another Adeline appears, and the mist returns, and she is as before. So this is a very poetic way of, Hester's just purely thinking about it in like duality of personality in psychological terms, but it is a very big literary hint to maybe that's not Adeline, if she can behave so differently.
I think this, okay, that is you, the poet, that got that. I think it's beautiful. I mean, there were some lines in here too that were beautifully written, and I have circled a couple of things too, but that makes sense. And then the poetic way to describe that, makes sense. I thought it was interesting talking about just the way the phrasing of different things in this novel, how it starts is it was November. It's like, all right, here we go. But something just as fellow readers that I thought was interesting, let me see if I can find it, was this line, our client's faces, when she's Margaret is talking about, you know, she and her father's bookstore, our client's faces with the customary outward paleness and inner glow of the book lover seem to light up when they spot the rich colors of the paperback books. I just thought her phrasing of our clients with the customary outward paleness and inner glow of the book lover was, I was like, that's kind of like a little bit of a slam, but also kind of a nice way to put it. It's like, I'm pale. Give me a break. I don't know. I don't get a lot of sun. It's okay.
What do you think about all the allusions to Jane Eyre and what is the author trying to say in paying homage to like almost all the Bronte sisters, but mainly it's Jane Eyre. So why do you think Jane Eyre was mentioned so much?
You know, if I had one kind of complaint, and I thought that at times it was a bit heavy-handed with the Jane Eyre references, that's just my opinion, obviously, but I got kind of like, all right, we get it, like you enjoy Jane Eyre is a big deal, let's keep this moving. But then kind of with the parallels, I don't know, I thought it was okay. I mean, maybe it's just my indifference toward Jane Eyre. Everybody in the book really seemed to really get it when they talk about Aurelius, his inheritance, and he has the little piece of paper with the words from Jane Eyre. She was like, oh man, I know this immediately. I'm glad there are a lot of Jane Eyre fans. That's great. But what were your thoughts?
Well, when I read this book, I had not yet read Jane Eyre, and so I wasn't fully aware. Like, I kind of knew the plot from film adaptations and whatnot, but I wasn't necessarily as annoyed by it just because I hadn't been exposed to Jane Eyre as much. But I, you know, going back and reading it and looking at this now, obviously I think the biggest similarities are the mansion burns down. That's just not Jane Eyre. And then I think the biggest thing is like this whole trope in Gothic literature of, and especially Jane Eyre, of there's a secret inhabitant in the house. And that's the biggest, you know, thing to like get out of with Jane Eyre and 13th Tale, because in Jane Eyre, it's the crazy mad wife and people think that she's a ghost because Rochester keeps her secluded. And in 13th Tale, it's the third sister / cousin, whatever. And in essence, no one except the Mrs. and John the Dig knows about her. Like, they don't even confide in Hester about her.
Right. Well, that's talking about Gothic tropes, you know, and then we're talking about Phantom of the Opera last week, and there's a dude hiding in the opera house. It's like, I guess everybody's hiding everywhere. I was trying to think of what we read, Otranto. Gotta be honest, don't remember all about that book right now. But
it wasn't really someone hiding, like Isabella was hiding in, you know, from Manfred's pursuit, but there wasn't anyone specifically hiding their existence like in those other ones.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay, I could see, you know, that was nice to give some nods to Jane Eyre. And that parallel makes a lot of sense. What were the other things with the Bronte sisters? Because I have not read a lot of the Bronte sisters.
I was reading a few articles and they just mentioned passing that the 13th Tale plays homage to Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights. And I'm just trying to think, where were the like allusions in like Wuthering Heights? Just the sort of the overall environment with the moors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah, we're doing Wuthering Heights for episode 6, so be ready.
I have read that one. It's been a minute, but I have read it. And I'm trying to think of the it did not come to mind when I was reading this, but I'm sure it will once I revisit. Because I just think of Wuthering Heights as so much more of a love story. There wasn't too much of a love, very briefly. There were little love stories. But nothing, wasn't the whole book. Anyway, Heathcliff and what's the girl's name in that? I don't remember. Oh my
I
God.
can't, oh my God, I can't remember.
Catherine. Is it Catherine?
Catherine.
Oh,
Catherine.
okay.
Such a generic name.
I confuse that and Jane Eyre sometimes. I don't know why.
Alrighty then. One thing I remember thinking, do you remember the scene where Margaret goes and visits Angelfield, like it's ruins for the first time, and then the doorknob turns on her?
Yes.
Yes, and I was just like, oh crap, what's gonna happen? And then it's what's his name? Aurelius?
Yeah.
Aurelius. So my first theory of when I first read the book was that Aurelius was Hester and the doctor's son.
Oh,
Did you think
interesting.
that? Did you have any theories at all of how Aurelius would fit into this story before the big reveal?
I knew he had to be somebody connected, but then I'd also sometimes I get really focused on the wrong things, and I did not understand why she was just like, sounds good. I'm gonna sit here and eat some cake and chill with you. I'd probably be like, dude, why are you in this house? I mean, I know I'm in this house too, but I don't. He must have had a very trusting face. That's all I could
I
think.
don't know.
So,
He's just this sweet country bumpkin. He kind of reminds me of Hagrid from Harry Potter.
okay. Yeah. Well, I could be friends with that. That's what kind of took me aback at first. But yeah, when the doorknob was turning, I was like, oh, what is going on here? I knew he was going to come up in the story. I did not know how. I figured he was somebody's son, but whose son it was, yeah, I didn't. It was Emmeline and
Oh, John the Diggs, apprentice, whatever. I forget his name too.
Ambrose? Or no, that's somebody else.
Again, just one of the like gardeners.
Yeah, but just yeah.
One of John the Diggs' lackeys.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And I'm kind of, Hester says that we don't know the exact nature of Emmeline's disabilities, but Hester is goes on to say that, she can be molded and trained to exist in polite society, and she could even possibly marry. But it kind of made me feel weird again with her relationship with the gardener. It just made me think of like, what is the nature of Emmeline's condition, and is she of the sound mind to give consent like that?
Yeah, there were a couple moments in this book, moreover, the ones we've read in the past, that Charlie is a problem, like obviously. With Emmeline, I guess I didn't really comprehend the nature of her disability. So Adeline, I mean, she was just I don't know, a psychopath, sociopath. I know there are different, very distinct definitions for those things, but shocker, everybody, I'm not a therapist or a psychiatrist. I was just curious what was her condition. She was very violent and jealous, and she basically to me was just Charlie. She was her dad, or well, he was definitely the father, but it was his daughter.
Speaking of twins, although it's extremely, extremely, extremely rare, it is biologically possible for twins to hail from two different fathers.
So, do you think they were from two different fathers?
That I'm just saying, and I've never thought about this in reading the book, but the way you were describing that Adeline is so much like her dad. Does that raise the question?
That would be interesting. I'm gonna
And
go with
that
that.
Emmeline came from, Isabel's actual husband.
Yeah, that's. I think I'm gonna go with that. I think that's a good twist. The plot has thickened even more.
The one thing I really liked, it seems the author was really into, the notion of twins and them having their own language and all the studies around twins, and she demonstrates that via Hester's fascination. But in regards to all the twin stuff, if I had one, could say one weakness about the book, I really didn't need Margaret's backstory of having a twin that died.
Yeah.
It didn't really do much for me. Like, I could have fully enjoyed, they're supposed to make the connection of, okay, it's about these twins, and Margaret knows she lost a twin, so there's supposed to be this camaraderie through that. But I don't necessarily think the story needed it to be as just as fulfilling as it was.
I agree. I think it was trying to, you know, portray her as a sympathetic, like you said, sympathetic to Vita's plight and to kind of really latch on. The thing that you brought up reminded me of the scene where Margaret's kind of losing it. And then the doctor is like, here, I'm going to prescribe you something. And it's to read Sherlock Holmes. I was kind of like, I don't know, because he basically kind of said, oh, you have a condition of women that read too many Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights and a Bronte sister's books. Like, you're being kind of ridiculous. I mean, that's at least how I felt. He was just kind of like, you're being crazy. Just read these books and chill out. And maybe it was a little dismissive of her, but she did kind of, you know what, to be quite honest, Margaret's story with her twin, it was less like, it created less sympathy for me or kind of like connection for her, and more just kind of was like, what is going on here? And I got a little confused. Because the father didn't know she knew about that until basically the end of the novel, and she was older. Is that right? Okay. So her mom was kind of like, you know, mad at her for basically no reason. I mean, she knew. It was because she had a sister that passed away. Yeah, I don't know. It could have been perfectly fine without it. I don't think it enriched.
I was thinking, especially in the twist of realizing that Emmeline is alive and living with Vida and that Vida was a third child, I thought they were going to go into something that it's not that her sister or her died. The sister is alive, but was raised separately from Margaret.
You know,
she was going to turn up, but that did not happen.
I thought there was going to be a connection between Margaret and Vida, and like there was some sort of biological connection somehow, but I guess she was a famous enough author. I don't know, but you can hide a third kid. Who knows? Good Lord. We can do anything in books. I don't know. Yeah. Interesting.
I know. I'm looking at my copy of 13th Tale. Like, when I read it for the first time, I checked it out from the library, but I found a really nice copy for just $1 at Half Price Books.
Mm. Love that. That's always nice.
Yes, and they have a few discussion questions in the back.
Oh, yeah, they did. Okay.
So, let's see. Much of the novel takes place in two grand estates, Angelfield and then Miss Winter's. How are the houses reflections of their inhabitants?
Ooh, that's a good, cool question. I love that.
I have a thought.
You take a stab at it. Yes, please.
I think it's like not so much a similarity, but a contrast. In Angelfield, Vida existed purely as a ghost. She didn't have any, supposedly not supposed to have any evidence of her presence. Whereas in her home, when she's an adult, it's completely covered with her identity, with her books and, you know, all her crazy stuff. She gives off this, you know, they describe her in this very bohemian fortune teller type of scenario that makes me think of Professor Trelawney from Harry Potter.
Yes, exactly.
So I think it's just, you know, just the Angelfield, she had no identity whatsoever. And then she is so and maybe because her identity was so suppressed that she is completely over the top, you know, as an adult in her surroundings and her decor.
Okay, yeah. I like the thought that Angelfield was kind of, I was pictured it, gosh, I wish I could, not quite the house and It's a Wonderful Life that they move into, but a little more grand than that. Made me think of something I'll come back to. But I like the kind of idea that Miss Winter's, you know, she couldn't have a presence at Angelfield, so she had a very big presence at her house. I think that's pretty cool to think about, which I'm going to tell you part of the book that confused me. Angelfield apparently had two big stone cats on the outside of it. Is that right?
Did it?
They kept saying they were sitting on the cats. And I was like, are we talking about cats, like cute furry cats? But then they were talking about sitting on them. I don't know.
It's possible. Having the two lions at the front door is very common in that type of British architecture.
Okay. Maybe they, it was maybe it was more lions than to me what, like, you know, my cats that are in the office with me. I just thought it would be an interesting decor choice. But yeah, I don't know. How did you picture Angel Field in your mind? Was it, I mean, I guess there are two versions of that. There was actually maybe even three, because there is a version before Hester arrives. Then when Hester arrives, she kind of cleans it up and makes it, you know, probably what it was intended to be. And then it kind of falls apart again. And then there's that disgusting scene about what happens, you know, in the place where Charlie's at.
Oh, I remember that. I remember reading that, and it just made me think of that TV show Hoarders.
Oh, yeah. Ugh, wasn't into
Yeah, so, well, Margaret first sees Angelfield, of course, as a ruin, and, you know, I just imagine it not being necessarily very scary, but actually, I just imagine it being quite pretty by being overgrown with vines and like that sort of thing. And then with Angelfield, I think it's left purposely ambiguous exactly when it takes place,
Hmm.
because I s actually started thinking of it as the like when they're children, you know, it taking place in actually like very early 20th century,
Okay.
whereas actually this has been adapted into a TV movie by BBC, and their costumes are much more of their childhood is much more 40s and 50s.
Interesting. Okay,
But I
but
think it's left deliberately ambiguous, kind of the sort of timelessness of the house. And even if it was maybe later in the 40s and 50s, I feel like the vibe they're trying to give is that they're so secluded and so isolated from the world that they're still basically operating in this very old school, early 20th century way of living.
okay. Okay. Did you watch the BBC version of it?
I tried really hard to find it,
Okay.
but I couldn't, and it was like $30 on Amazon, so I'm like,
Oh,
nope.
yeah,
Yeah, it
no.
was one thing that's interesting about the movie that have you seen Game of Thrones and the girl
Yes.
who plays Sansa Stark, Sophie
Yeah.
Turner?
Yeah.
So she has that long red hair, right?
Right.
So she plays one of the girls
That I saw it. Okay.
in that adaptation. And what's interesting is like, oh, I can kind of get it. Like, she's very well known for having that red hair. You know, that's why they cast her. But in an interview, a totally separate interview, nothing to do with that movie, Sophie Turner was talking about how she was a twin in her mom's womb and the other twin died and that it was a girl.
Oh.
So it
Oh,
makes me
yeah.
think of maybe that's a part of the reason why she took that role, because she has that personal experience of losing a twin.
That's really interesting. The stills I saw of her, and do you know which twin she played? Because I would be
Well, the thing
curious.
is, they had several girls playing the girls, you know, at different ages. So
Okay.
Sophie Turner plays the Vida at being older, but you don't realize that she's Vida, and then you realize that there's a totally different person that's Adeline. So I think haven't seen it, but I think they played off as Sophie Turner playing like the real Vida, the third girl.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Olivia Colman, I like her, and she's Margaret, which that's pretty cool. I just pulled up the cast list because I'm curious. They've got a great cast. I don't know. BBC usually does it pretty right. So, how I kind of I'm sad to know that that's $30 to rent because I wanted to see it, but
I think it's 30 to buy, but yeah, it was ridiculous and I wasn't willing to pay it.
yeah, no, that's too much. This feels like it would be a very, you know, there's some books that I've read and I'm like, okay, that's going to be easily adapted to a screen of some sort. And this one seemed like it might be a little complex, but I'm sure it was done well.
Okay, here's another discussion question. As the story unfolds, we learn that Margaret and Miss Winter are both twins. What else do they have in common? Which again kind of goes back to my notion of they didn't need the twin thing because I feel like there was plenty more else to work with.
Ooh, they both obviously love Jane Eyre. No, I'm sorry, sad to say that. I think they both were kind of antisocial in not a negative way. They just like to kind of keep to themselves, you know,
I
so
feel
much.
like just the aura of, whether it was specifically about twins, they both share the aura of just having secrets and having to keep secrets from, like, family, because Margaret never really told her mom that she knew about what had happened, and then Vida on her part just never was able to really tell anyone about her existence. And so I think just that whole aura of mystery and isolation is what bound them together.
Yeah, that I agree wholeheartedly. I have nothing else to say with that.
Okay, let's see. Miss Winter frequently changes the point of view from third to first person, from they to we to I, in telling Margaret her story. The first time she uses I is in the recounting of Isabel's death and Charlie's disappearance. What do you make of this shifting when Margaret points it out on page 204?
I, for a second, you know, looking back, knowing what we know, it was probably her transitioning into Adelaine, but I just kind of assumed it was her getting too into the story. I don't know. At the time, I was just like, oh, well, she slipped up, kind of not a big deal. Or, I mean, it was obviously a big deal because she, Margaret noted it, but yeah. I guess I didn't think too much about it. I think I just was like, oh, okay. How about you? What did you think about that?
Well, I first thought about it as, okay, is she psychologically finally distancing herself from her sister? But then upon reading the big reveal, you realize that it's a very strategic move on the writers and Vida's storytelling, because she wants to tell the quote-unquote truth, but there are times where she's using we and they, so she can still portray herself as being Adelaine, even though she wasn't.
Yeah.
So, like, because when, like, the first time, one of the big times of her using I is, you know, clearly not trying to be Adelaine, is when she goes into the woods and realizes that Charlie has blown his brains out.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
That was one of the more vivid, you know, images to me, and the fact that she just doesn't tell anyone.
How wild. I mean, yeah.
It does feed into that notion of this could be Adelaine, because just it's so out of touch with what a quote-unquote normal person would do upon seeing such a thing, you know. So it's able to keep up this facade that maybe, you know, Adelaine, she is Adelaine, and she actually is realizing that her violence doesn't work in normal society, and she has to, you know, tone it down a bit.
Yeah.
But that it's still there.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm glad you brought that up with Charlie, because that was pretty jarring to come across. I'm sure in reality it was even more jarring. Well, you know, fictional reality. So something that I kind of was confused about and wasn't sure I fully understood, the benefit of keeping his death a secret, other than just to be able to, like, not be taken into, you know, some other sort of care and just to live with the Mrs. and the John the Dig. But I don't know. I didn't know why she didn't say anything.
Well, I think now that we know that there's a third child, like, if there had just been the two that were known to be in existence and they went into other people's care, like, whatever, that still Mrs. and John the Dig wouldn't have liked that. But I think for her specifically, she, Vida, lives in such isolation, like, she would be so terrified at the thought of, what if these random people come in and realize I'm here, what would happen to me? I live completely off the grid. Mm-hmm. So I think for her, that was a move in self-interest and self-preservation, because she was significantly more at risk than the actual twins.
Right. Interesting. Sorry.
So let's see. Another question. The story shifts significantly after the death of Mrs. Dunn and John the Dig. Adelaine steps forward as intelligent, well-spoken, and confident, and the girl in the mist emerges. Do you believe this miraculous transformation? If not, what do you suspect was really going on?
Whoa. I did not think about that in the slightest. Okay, I'm revisiting the question, because that's a pretty loaded question. What are your thoughts?
I think, again, it's stemming from what I've said several times before, is that for a moment, like, the reason we thought that Vida was Adelaine was because we were thinking maybe she was making a natural progression in realizing that, okay, my sort of my volatile behavior isn't going to get me what I want as I get older. I'm going to have to be more cunning, more manipulative, and more deceitful to get what I want. And we think that's a natural progression, but it ends up actually being two people. And so for, I think, in just specifically Adeline, I think it begs the question of, did the real Adeline ever make that sort of transition, like, at all, in being any less violent than what she was? Because I would think maybe she did a little bit, but clearly not enough to, you know, think it's a good idea in her jealousy to burn a baby in a fireplace.
Another very horrific scene in that book. Yeah, maybe it was just tempered for a little bit, and then it's just like something barked, you know, reignited that compulsion. Yeah, I don't know. I guess, you know, thinking about it, the miraculous transformation was a little suspect, but, you know, I'm just kind of like, I was like, yeah, people do weird things. I don't know. And then it reemerged. So
when did you first suspect Mrs. Winter's true identity? Whether you knew or not, looking back, what clues did she give to Margaret and what clues did the author give to you?
True identity, meaning...
That there was a third kid.
Oh my God, I had no idea until the end.
Like there was nothing that made you suspicious?
No. I had to read it, you know, the end a couple, or where they had that reveal a few times. I'm like, really? And then I did the thing where I'm like, what did I overlook? I just couldn't think of something, you know, I guess other than the question we just discussed, but... Yeah, no, I totally didn't get it. And then I just was frustrated because I'm, like I said, usually I can kind of figure those things out. You know, like we were talking about in The Phantom of the Opera, it's like, okay, we obviously know what's going on here. But no idea. How about you?
For me, I think I already stated, I never guessed the third child aspect. The only way I really, really, really grew suspicious was, like I said, with the totally differing reactions of John the Dig to supposedly the same little savage. And that was the only thing that kind of like threw me off, that maybe I'm missing something. But again, I never would have guessed that that there was a third child.
That was just such a good twist. That was such a good ghost. I was proud of this ghost, this go around.
Alrighty then. Are you ready to move on to the Gothometer?
Yes, and I already wrote down my ratings, so.
Alrighty then, nice. I have not written down my ratings, so. Okay. So I'm going to do this on the fly. Let's see. So atmosphere/setting, what do you rate The 13th Tale?
I gave it a 9. I felt like it kind of met all the, or ticked all the boxes that needed to be there for, you know, to fit some of those tropes. I mean, with this book, knowing it's a contemporary work and it is kind of a nod in a way to Gothic literature from the days of old, it was kind of easy to set up the atmosphere that way. So I gave it a 9. How about you?
Yeah, because it's just so much in that old school mansion in the moors. I give it a 9 as well.
Cool. Good.
Alrighty then. The past. What do you rate the past being in The 13th Tale?
I guess I'm going all in on this book because I gave the past a 10. I mean, it's, you know, the retelling is a retelling of the past and all... To me, that's what the book was about the past. I don't have any other justification other than that. How about you?
Yes, I have to agree. The past is a huge portion because it's not just the retelling of the story, but then also like just the past within the past, that this child grew up in this house and no one knew about it, not even a governess like living with them, and the whole implications of Charlie and Isabel's screwed up relationship and how has that impacted their children and all that stuff.
Right. So you're giving it a 10 as well?
Yeah. Based on incestuous madness, I'm giving it a 10.
Okay. Yeah. It was definitely passed upon past. It was very layered. pass.
Category three, the supernatural. What do you give it?
I'm giving it an 8. I have, like I said, the ghost was really good. It wasn't heavy-handed supernatural throughout. I feel like, you know, that wasn't the full story. It was part of the story. And so I give it an 8.
I'm going to go a little farther and give it a 9 just because, cool. You know, just the notion of what do we think of the word as ghost? Like, can a ghost, you know, in this way, a ghost is taking on a more metaphorical sense of the third child is a living, breathing being, but she lives completely off the grid. She does not exist in any way in the society that civilization has manufactured for itself. So does that in a way make her an actual ghost? She doesn't exist on paper, the way we've structured society.
Right.
So I think for that, and then also I think the supernatural, not necessarily supernatural, but certainly the psychological element of the sort of madness with the girls having their own differing mental disorders. I kind of put their sort of behavior and their sort of conditions kind of in a supernatural category as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so I give it a 9.
Cool.
Heroes, heroines, and villains. What do you rate it?
I gave this a 2. I gave it a really low score. And I mean, in thinking about not like in a Joseph Campbell, you know, hero's journey sort of sense. And we've kind of talked about heroes and villains, but there were a lot of important characters. But, you know, we kind of talked about Vida's moral compass. You know, I think that was kind of the nice thing about this. There was nobody was perfectly perfect. Nobody was outrightly villainous. I mean, I guess Charlie was a villain. I'm not a fan, but, and John the Dig was probably the kind of cleanest character. He seemed to be the most sympathetic. So I'm giving it a 2. How about you?
I'm going to give it a 4 because again, for similar reasons that, you know, it wasn't really structured with that hero villain dichotomy, which is nice because that gets old after a while.
Yeah.
But I gave it a 4 because I find it interesting. In a way, I see Hester as a failed heroine. Like, because she goes in really trying to want to help the girls and help reintegrate them into society. And she just fails in every possible way. And it's an interesting, you know, twist from Jane Eyre because, you know, a lot of stories are the main character and their perspective is the new person who goes into the house, whether as a governess or some other sort of, you know, visitor and slowly having to unravel the secrets of the house. Where in this case, it's all from the perspective of the people like within the house trying to stay insulated and keep their like little small bubble intact.
Yeah.
So yeah, for that, for Hester only, I give it a 4.
Okay. That I think that's fair.
Mystery, what would you rate it?
I gave it this a 10. And again, I did not see, wasn't thinking about, I'm trying to formulate my thought here, giving it a 10. The fact that the reveal of the third sister caught me so off guard, because honestly, for a while, because that happened so close to the end of the novel, I just figured, I was like, well, it's probably a ghost or something, but we're just going to kind of leave it, you know, hanging out there. Really surprised me. And I really enjoyed that aspect of the novel. Also mysteries with, you know, people's birth, where they come from. You know, Vida says at the beginning of the story, you know, your birth really isn't the beginning of your story, and kind of talks about her parents. I thought that was an interesting way to present that. So I'm going all in and I'm giving it a 10.
Okay. Mystery myself as well, I was giving it a 10 because it's just a really nice setup, because you think in the beginning of the story that at least with Vida's identity, you think it's totally set in stone because Margaret is able to confirm that Adeline did exist and that, you know, she saw the birth certificate and everything. And it's like, okay, this is what she used to be and this is what she changed her name to. Like, there's no possible loophole to get around that part. Is there? And turns out there is. And so a mystery, despite all the other mysteries, there is even the mystery that you didn't know within the mystery.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's what I kind of fumbled there, because it's like the mystery was, I had no idea. So Cool. Well, I don't know if you wanted me to give the totals.
Yeah, I saw your total is 39
Yes.
and my total is 42.
Hey, so we're keeping these pretty close. So,
Yeah. What do you think of the notion that the most contemporary book we've read is the most gothic on our gothometer?
I think this book has the advantage of being contemporary. I think it's, like being able to have a body of work to reference to create something is it gives it an advantage. But yeah.
I think the whole point is that it was a deliberate plan on the author's part to pay homage to super classical gothic literature. It's not like Phantom of the Opera. We gave it actually quite a low score, not necessarily because it was quote unquote any less gothic, but gothic has since evolved into various notions of horror and paranormal romance and all sorts of things like that. And this was very much trying to stay to that very traditional narrow definition of what gothic used to be.
It's interesting, and spoilers for the movie Parasite right now. So I guess stop for me. I don't know. Have you seen Parasite?
I have not, but to go ahead, you can spoil it.
Okay. I watched it this weekend, and without, without spoiling it, I watched it this weekend and thought it was an interesting, it could be viewed in the lens of Gothic. And I would be curious, if you were to watch it, just what your thoughts would be, because there are some themes that we've discussed even today that show up in Parasite. So
Is it on Netflix or Amazon Prime?
it's on Hulu for free.
Oh, okay.
Deserved Best Picture. That's what I think. So yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'll need to take a look at it. So, are you ready for our special rereading?
Yes, I am.
I'm going to pick something.
Beautiful.
Getting around, just flipping the book. Okay, let's see. Obeying Dr. Clifton's instructions, I spent 2 days in bed, eating and sleeping and reading Sherlock Holmes. I confess I overdosed on my prescribed treatment, gulping down one story after another. Before the end of the second day, Judith had been down to the library to fetch another volume of Conan Doyle for me. She had grown steadily kind towards me since my collapse. It was not for the fact that she was sorry for me that altered her, though she was sorry, but the fact that now Emmeline's presence was no longer a secret in the house, she was at liberty to let her natural sympathies govern her exchanges with me instead of maintaining a constant guarded facade.
There was a lot happening in that passage, I think.
So what it seems to be this is the perspective of Margaret, and she's bedridden, but it's as it says, she's finally realized, and we finally had the scene in the garden where she realizes that Emmeline is alive.
Yeah.
And that not only is she alive, but that she's living with Vida.
Why that wild,
Again,
wild.
like Rochester and his crazy wife and the third child, it's double hiding someone in the house.
I just put that together. Oh my gosh. Get these, check your ha I mean, I guess they all were cool with them being there. They just didn't want anybody else to know that. And then there's the Sherlock Holmes thing with her reading the Sherlock. Okay, why do you think he asked her to read Sherlock Holmes?
Just trying to get her detective juices flowing. Because I think, just because Dr. Clifton, when she first comes to the house to, and he realizes what she's doing, and he's like, "So, the 13th tale, did you get it out of her yet?"
That's funny that you bring that up, because the title of the book, I don't think we really talked about, because it kind of ends up not being as important as it's made. I guess you could argue that her life story is the 13th tale. Or wait a minute. She finds it and it's kind of like a half written, what is the la what is that story that she's rewriting? I totally forgot. Let me look.
Yeah, because basically, yeah, the 13th tale is just is the mythos around the author, where she wrote these 13 tales in this one book, decided to drop one of them, but even though at the last minute still a few editions misprints went out as still calling the book the 13th tale, and the And it's since been changed to, you know, Tales of Change and Desperation. So yeah, the whole thing is, what is the 13th tale? Was it her life? Was she going to give some semblance of this story to her readers in the very beginning and decided not to? But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in reading Conan Doyle, yeah, from your question, I think he's just trying to get her detective and deductive juices flowing too.
Okay.
Yeah, and then just reading this passage makes me think of like the shock I felt when I saw Emmeline, and then just the sadness of Emmeline digging in the ground for her baby.
Yes.
It's just so sad and so pathetic. And again, seeing Emmeline like this, even though she's docile and certainly wasn't volatile like Adeline, it again begs those questions of consent and, like, you know, like, was it good for her to have a child, or, you know, all those things.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also made me think of, with Emmeline, the fact that, you know, twin language, and Margaret realizing that their twin language is kind of based off French.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting, which makes sense because the author actually does have a degree in French literature.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's...
Yeah, and what? A lot of times twin language is based off, you know, certain languages, which kind of makes sense because in this sort of environment, you know, in England, being educated by governess, French would have been a big part of that type of curriculum.
Okay, interesting. I just looked at the author's
and even, right, you know, the passage I just read right after, it's like, and she never said anything about the 13th tale, she asked me wistfully one day. This is Judith asking Margaret. So everyone is so desperate to know about the 13th tale, and Margaret's just like, shove off, I don't know yet.
Right. Right. Yeah, that is kind of it's interesting because it's highlighting kind of Margaret's status in the world. I guess it would be like, I don't know if this is a, I know that you're a big Harry Potter fan. So if there was like, would it be like if J.K. Rowling had something of the equivalent, like if it was, is it the Beetle Bard, is it 13 Tales of Beetle Bard? Is that right?
No, Tales of Beetle the Bard.
Yeah. If it was something like that, I guess everybody's question probably to her would be like, where's this other story? Like, I don't know.
Everyone's dying for her to create a story of the Marauders era, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I was going to say, I'm sure, you know, if you're a popular enough author, then there's that work that people are desperate for. And I guess that kind of reiterated her popularity too, is by having people just be like, hey, what's the deal with this? So interesting.
Alrighty then. So that wraps up the 13th tale. Again, a pretty good one for our first contemporary one, a true homage to all things Gothic and all their tropes. Next time, we are going to switch things up a bit, and we are going to go into short stories and poetry, specifically those by Edgar Allan Poe. I'm really excited to hear. It seems that you are quite excited to read The Black Cat, which that's one of my favorites too.
I've read it, and it it's for a cat lover, parts of that are hard to read, but it's okay.
But it's good. And then we can discuss the kind of notion of how does American Gothic kind of differ from the super classical, like British in the Manor House, you know, with Edgar Allan Poe.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. I'm excited to hear the poetry analysis because, I'm less familiar with, man, it's been a long time since I've read some of Poe's poetry. So I guess I'll be reading it very soon.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tune in next time for all things Edgar Allan Poe. Bye.
Bye.